Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. We're going to get into a topic today near and dear to my heart. It's down the road of community policing, which anybody who knows me knows that that's, you know, kind of where I am. You know, we got, I don't know if Izzy will make it today, but we got the powerhouses in the house anyway. And we're going to come very solution-oriented today. What we're going to do today is give you a step-by-step power play on how to get your neighborhood to the next level. We want to deal with systemic crime. And before we get to the co-host, I want to say we're going to separate crime, what is crime, and we're going to say this is systemic. That means it's problem areas, problem crime, problem things that are plaguing communities. Crimes of passion and crimes of opportunity are two different things. The police cannot control these things. I mean, it's just somebody wakes up, decides they want to do something. There's very little the police can do about it. So we're going to weed those out, and we're going to deal with the things that empower the people in communities that want to make a change in their neighborhood, that are tired of it. And we're going to go down through and you know, give the steps to how to do that. Good morning, Sharon. Good to see you. All right, Big Joe, what's up? How you feeling, bro?
I'm good. I'm ready to roll.
All right, Tony, what's up?
I'm good, man. I'm ready to roll. I'll just take what Joe's paying attention.
All right. Chief, what's going on?
Wow, those are kind of short intros. I'm good. It's a good week. Going on vacation. So, hey, you know, first one in 3 years. So I figured take advantage of it while I can. So,
hey, you remember, I said before, not fair, not fair.
Not fair, but they actually allowed me to be gone for at least a week. So, but hey, you know, I couldn't miss the show. You know, of course, I'm not leaving until tomorrow anyway. So, but yeah, I want to be here. Interesting topic, and I think we're gonna have a lot to get in on this issue here today.
You know, and coming up with the topic, Chief. You know, I looked at all the stuff we're seeing today: shootings everywhere. Neighborhoods that are already plagued with crime. They already got it piled up. The last thing they need are the crimes of passion and crimes of opportunity piled on top of that. And so we all tend to look at it and we judge it as all crime. Yes, technically it's all crime. That's true. But in that, what can we fix right now? And what I wanted to do today with this show is really teach and empower the people, good morning, Rachel, the people in communities across the country, across the world that listen, that we're going to give them some answers and some keys. And some of the things I will talk about, I actually did in Waco, Texas, in the 90s, when, by the way, Waco was number one per capita in the United States for violent crime and the least desirable place to live, where today $1,200 will get you a two-bedroom apartment and in semi-okay neighborhood. That's fact. It's researchable. Y'all can check that out for yourself. And the chief is right here. He can tell you. He lives in the area. So I wanted to lead off and say, you know, I think that we can't talk about systemic crime and without talking about community policing, which obviously to me is the answer. The problem, I think, with community policing is a lot of chiefs walk out and they talk about that after the shooting when the media is there, but they don't implement community policing. So, Chief, before I get to you, I'm going to name the three types of policing that predominantly run police departments. You know, we have call-driven, L.A., Chicago, Las Vegas, you know, New York City. They're doing call-driven policing. They're coming out. Those officers are coming into their beat. They're at the office that morning, and as soon as they walk in, they've got 20, 30 calls holding and just there be. And they're trying to get these calls off of there. That's called driven. They're not pulling people over. They're not doing traffic stops. They don't have time for that. They're just trying to clear calls. The sergeants are stressed and they're yelling, clear the call, clear the call, clear the call. And then you have problem-oriented policing. Problem-oriented policing looks very good on paper. It looks like it's reaching the community, but probably problem-oriented policing deals with Stan coming to Tony's house to deal with Tony on Tony's problem, which betters Tony, but it has no impact on the neighborhood. It doesn't have an impact on my beat. It doesn't make my call out any better. Now, community policing, by definition, is a partnership between citizens and the community. It provides for, here comes the word, a shared responsibility in solving community-related problems. That is the textbook definition. And community policing must be, not should be, not could be, not if the budget allows it. Hello, police chiefs across America. I'm talking to y'all. Not if the budget allows it. Community policing has to be instituted from the top down. That's for the chief to the janitor, to the civilians, to the SWAT team, to the drug enforcement team, to the officers on the street, to the detectives. And it transitions over into city management. Hello, city council people. You're not off the hook. Hello, mayor. You're not off the hook. It has to be a citywide buy-in to community policing for it to work. So when you hear your department say, we have a community policing unit, and they've got 300 officers, and they've got a seven-person community police unit, that is not community policing. That's crime prevention. Chief?
You're right. We discussed this in the past that I'm just going to break it down in teaching the patrol section for the state of Texas. For all new recruits that come through McClellan County, one of the things that we have in the PowerPoint presentation when we teach patrol operations is the saying that every officer is a community police officer, every one of them. Now, I get the idea of the organization, the unit, okay? And some of that has to go back to what you said about the call-driven agencies where, you gotta make a call there, a balance as chief, whether we have more people to answer the calls or do we get the unit together and try to solve some of these issues. You know, I think it's interesting that you have the three, and you're very found those online to designate the types of policing, but the reality of it is it should be all three, right? If you have the last two, problem-oriented policing and community policing, hopefully it drives down the call driven. So if you think and concentrate on those two, my theory is that if you work on problem-oriented policing in conjunction with community policing, because they can't be two separate things, they have to be one entity, mm-hmm. It should get rid of the call volume. We would think in most places, but some places it's not going to work. One of the things I really want to ask for community policing and or problem-oriented policing to work, they are specific to a certain type of area. What works in Chicago is not going to work in my few pieces of it. But the whole program itself, you can't shove it to an entity. It has to do with the size of the community. It has to do with the problems, specific problems in the community. There are some instances where community policing / problem-oriented policing aren't even the same from district to district, beat to beat. You have to define it for yourself, and not only do you define it for yourself with the agency, but you've got to have the stakeholders, which are the people of your community, to come in and say these are the things that we want to get done, or these are what we find important, for police to do. It needs to be pushed down from the top. Every officer is a community police officer. That's it. All right, and give them the latitude to solve some of these problems as they come across them. And I know as we go on, I'm not going to keep on talking, but as we go on the show, I've got specific examples of individual officers, no rank, just told, we call them slick sleeves, right? Solving problems,
yeah.
Right? And on a call for service, and then he gets pushed up, and he goes through a chain of command, and chief, this is what happened on that call. Well, We don't have to go out there anymore. That's great. Reason enough to do something else.
Hey, man. Big Joe, what you think, bro?
I can't disagree. I mean, he just stole my thunder. my man's back on. The other issue is that in most of these agencies, they try to put a numerical value on it, and you can't. For a long time, I mean, up until actually this new administration, it defunded community policing as it stood.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what the chief said is right on the money. The reality is that it's a thought process. It's a way of life, per se. We have to change the paradigm, and we're talking about this again, paradigm shift within the departments. What is the service we're delivering and how to deliver? So the delivery systems have to change. But let me just say this is something that really goes to the heart of policing, discretion. Have we taken discretion out of policing? And that's the problem. We certainly are doing that. They're legislating you out of, you know, we talk about empowering the police, but then again, you turn around and you hamstring them by taking away discretionary values. As crazy as that sounds, it's a fact. Am I not right, Jim?
I do. No, you're 100% correct. I mean, discretion is such a valuable tool. And you know, we have some elected officials that...
There we go. That's what I'm talking about. Out of here.
Yeah, you have elected officials that say, well, the officers don't need to have that discretion. We need to tell them they have to do A, B, and C, D. And what happens with that is, and there are laws currently on the books but across the country. You know, specifically, I'll talk about Texas. I'm not really sure about it, but family violence. Okay, so if the family violence assault contact, if somebody actually has been assaulted, an arrest is going to be made. The law says you shall make an arrest. At the minimum, conduct a report, but that person's during arrest. Violation of the protective order in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That person will be arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, think about the discretion issue where you go to, let's say, theft call. Theft under 100, right? I'm going to make it really bad. Individual person doesn't have enough money to afford food for their children, right? So they're stealing food to feed their family, okay? Walmart the entity, let's say they don't want to prosecute, they have a certain threshold where they will actually file charges, and that's true. That actually happens today. For a certain value of theft, the company will not press charges. They just want that person trespassed from location. Imagine that, okay? Walmart doesn't want to prosecute, but the law changes where that discretion is taken away from theft, and it says for any this value of theft, $100 plus, you will make an or you shall arrest. I mean, again, I'm playing devil's advocate. I don't think they would do that with a theft statute, but that's what the issue is with discretion, giving the officers or the agency, the officers and the agency, the latitude to make some certain type of decisions. What you see on social media. Where and it happens for now, not again, where somebody is arrested or detained for theft, the officers show up and they realize, well, this person's not a criminal, they're just money, right? They can't buy diapers.
Yeah, they're hungry.
They're hungry. They can't buy diapers or formula for their child. And the officers pay, right? They talk to the business and they pay for the items and they send that person on and, you know, help them out. You have the opportunity for that to not happen. We wouldn't be able to do things like that. That's what discretion is. That's where communities really can build good, strong issues to take care of these problems is through that discretion. Just as Joe said, I mean, it's 100% legit, and we have it being attempted to be taken away from us all the time.
You know, Chief, and you mentioned politicians, and I want to bring them in. They're not getting a pass. You know, not here. You know, and they are important because I'm going to go by personal experience of what I saw as a community police officer. You know, even when the program went away in Waco, I continued to be a community police officer till the time I left. You know, but this is what I've seen, and this is why I think that community policing is not instituted and implemented in a lot of communities. It's because typically, I'm just going to throw out an example. nobody's feelings, please. If your feelings get hurt, okay, get mad or go listen to something else, you know. But we have, if we go into most major cities along the river, you have your factories there. You have also your poor people there, your low-income people. So that is an area that was historically the bad place to live. So when you come in as a community police officer and you teach these people, you deal with not just what their social issue is, but you say, how, if I fix this, how do I expand this, fixing this to the entire area? And that brings in more people, and they get to know Stan, because I'm painting a house with you. I'm digging out a sidewalk with you. You know, they get to have your little city cell phone number, and they can call and talk to you. And sometimes that means a lot to people who have nothing, and everybody's telling them what to do to talk to you. But you get there, you start solving their problems. They start taking pride, and we're going to get into my theory of the mice, the roaches, and the rats, and that's why that is sitting on the picture, because it's very important. But when you start empowering people and they take pride in where they live, and all of a sudden their biggest dream isn't, I need to move over here to have a nice life. They start to believe, I'm okay where I'm at. And you start impacting crime, their property value tends to go up. That's a good thing. That's what we all want. What is our job as police officers? To stop crime, prevent crime. Okay, but when we start doing that, now you're investors. Hello, somebody's good buddy that's donating to their campaign. The investors can't get that property cheap anymore. And now we, in the late 80s, early 90s, we had white flight. That is a fact. Everybody fled to the suburbs. But then they couldn't get internet out there. So now everybody wants to move back into the city, and the big dream almost across the country is to live on the river in a loft apartment with a bistro underneath. There's one problem. These poor people have that property. So what are we going to do to them? Eminent domain. We're going to push them out. We're going to lock them up. And this is the politicians. This is not the police chiefs. This is not the officers. The mandate flows down. See, that's why we do this show. Nobody's got a safe-ass place they can go to. We're going to go on and get to it. So now we displace these communities. We price them out. We tax them out of their houses. And we build what we want to build. And that, I think, politicians have been the biggest enemies. I don't care what they say, vote for me, community policing. A lot of them have been the biggest enemies of the true department-wide / city-wide implementation of community policing, which is the number one solution to 90%, or I'll say 80%, of the problems between police community relations.
It's funny because a friend of mine who's also on here says just because you have a reduction in crime doesn't mean that's directly attributable to police action. It's very true. You know, so speak it, lie, lie, speak. That's the other problem. How do you prove up this thesis statement that policing works? But the other thing that I have that bothers me is that if you look at most of the squad cars in the country, police across the country, they all say the same thing, serve and protect. That's kind of a crock of whatever. But interesting also because when we talk about all these other issues, we talk about root causes. We look at who's doing this, and I've said this on other shows, we've got three groups that are dysfunctioning. We've got academicians, theoreticians, and politicians. The end users never get consulted as to what do they need, what do they want. And so you get that academician who comes up with a postulate who gives it to the politician who then enacts it into law, and then the theoretician gives it back to us in a form that we have to enforce it. And again, the end user is never consulted. The other part is you want to buy it. I need to ask the officers what they think.
Sometimes, that part.
If you look at most department regs, and again, I looked at Texas, I looked at New York, and particularly Chicago, it says that you will not transport people in your car. Well, thank God, case off, I can tell the story again, but I used to pick up, I've seen people stand on the bus stop, you know, 2 or 3 feet of snow. Tony, you remember that stuff? 2 or 3 feet of snow with kids. I put him in the squad car. Now, you heard this term before, vindictive policing. I had some people I worked for who didn't like me because I did what was right. They tried to jam me. Oh, yeah, there's some. There's a few of them.
Shift boss of 25 years over here. what you get in the car with them and see what they have to deal with when all of your social programs you voted for are closed. No resources available. See, it's that part. And I think the community, and I was talking to a brother earlier today, about 2 hours ago, and we talked about it. I said, I think the problem is you have frustration in the communities, and because they don't know about the inner workings of policing, which is why we do this show, that they can't really articulate their frustration, but it doesn't take away from the fact that they're rightfully pissed off and should be. Not at the officers, but they don't, many of them don't know. They just think it's the officers and the chief, and it rests there. No, it doesn't rest there. We need to start lighting some other people's asses up and don't put on a badge and a gun. And then you'll start seeing some changes in the people who do put on the badge and the gun, not because the mandate has come down to change, but because somebody finally let the chief be the chief. Or you hire a chief that has a pair that is willing to do the job.
You know, I can't disagree. I will say I'm fortunate. I'm absolutely fortunate with my government leaders allowing us to do the things that we need to get done. I think the proof was, the proof is in my community, you know, number one. Number two, you're exactly right. Some of that stuff is they're holding on to that individual and trying to direct them into, you know, special interest areas that they want fixed. And you see it across the country. You see it where some chief positions become politicized.
Mm-hmm.
They're not chiefs. They're not police officers. Mm-hmm. They're politicians. And if they're forced into that spot, and, you know, ultimately what happens is they'll lose their job. Okay? For me, the way that I look at that is, you know, I have a job, and I can get another job. You know, that's the way that I – but right is right. You know, and if you're really interested in fixing problems, you're going to have to get a little dirty, right?
That's
you're
going
to have to get out there and you're going to have to be on the street. I love the idea about politicians riding in the police car on these nights. I've had that for multiple occasions for my council members getting in a squad car with other officers and then roll around and see what happens. It's a great perspective as to what's taking place. But that's a big component. That's a big part of it. And again, that's part of the chief's job is that engagement. At least my opinion. You know, I've got to get to stay on that. You know, have some meaningful conversations with my elected officials about the things that we see in future planning. You know, I mean, that's a huge part of it. When, you know, you've got certain things happening in your community, and they're 3-4 years out, you need to start planning for those things now, right? You need to start getting ready for that to take place. But you're 100% right.
But, Chief, I need you to recycle a story, though, because you did something that a whole lot of police chiefs, number one, would not have done, but you did it because it was right for the community. It was not politically right. It probably potentially wasn't a career boosting comment that you made, but you did it because it's in who you are. And it was in regards to a question that you had from somebody, no, we don't have to mention any names, about why more tickets aren't written. You remember that story?
That's always been a big deal, you know, in communities across, you know, as we move forward in law enforcement, let's just be real about it. Tickets are written for revenue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of places, a lot of agencies rely upon that revenue to come in. If you really knew the story about the revenue, man, I don't even know what the breakdown is, but I'd say 80% of it goes to the state of Texas. It does not come back to the local
community. Right.
It's a small amount of our situation. So your highways and a lot of the major state projects are funded by that ticket revenue. And I get it. But we have this issue about, you know, the fact we need more tickets, we need more tickets, we need more tickets. And I explained, we're writing tickets. We're writing the tickets to people that deserve deserve tickets. You know, the idea is to focus on, it's a safety-related issue. I mean, yeah, your car being unregistered. Yeah, I mean, that happens. But what about speeding? No seatbelt, running stop signs. It can cause accidents and actually hurt people. That's what we should focus on. But the other part of it is when you get into that and it's an elected official that keeps pushing. Well, so we're gonna oversight our population. We're going to punish our people that live in our community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, So we need more, we need more, we need more. And I know stories from my community in the past where that was a measure of your success.
Yep, as an officer
was how many you wrote. I came from early on in my career where I could knock out 20, 25 tickets a day if I wanted to, but that didn't measure anything. It was solving a problem.
Okay.
I mean, let's fix these issues.
But let's do this, Chief, before I go to Tony, because you just opened up something else that I want to delve into, and if we come back to it, we come back to it. Because you talked about, and this has always been my issue, we're trying to evaluate officers. This has always been my issue. Joe, Chief, you've been out there doing the job. There's always that young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed rookie who's writing tickets to everybody. Your dog peed on the wrong side of the hydrant. He's writing a ticket. And you're hearing about him in roll call. He's getting bolstered up, and he's going to go out there and be more motivated. And that's fine, do you? I was never a big ticket person. But you're punishing that community. And I had this question one day in roll call. I'll just say a senior official who boosted this little young officer who's writing tickets. And I'm the senior person in the room. She says, you only wrote X amount of tickets that month. I said, yeah, I only worked X amount of accidents that month. That's it. Accident, I got to write a ticket. If it's a violation and I can prove it is, you ran a stop sign, hit this person, you know, it is what it is. I said, but also while this guy is taking everybody to jail on a barking dog ticket warrant or, you know, something minor, and he's gone off the street for 2 hours, who's going over there working his burglary motor vehicles? Who's going over there working the burglary habitation? I'm out of my area covering his area because of a traffic arrest. So this is the problem I think policing fails to do. We like to go to statistics. We like to go to numbers to justify when we want things. We want a grant. We want this. We want that. And we use all these numbers that we magically can bring up to justify what we want. You know the number we never bring up? Prevention. What about that one officer who, when he or she is working, nobody's getting murdered? There are no vehicle burglaries. That is our job, primarily. They don't get the parking space out front. They don't get officer of the year. But this guy who writes all the tickets, and that's fine, go join a traffic unit or go to DPS. But he's getting all these accolades. So what are we teaching? Produce things, and when it's quiet, make things up. Instead of preventing. Go ahead, Joe.
But this, again, the problem becomes, well, how do we codify those elements that we're trying to reach? And there's the problem. See, we need to codify wrong. I need to codify right. To measure the prevention aspect. I mean, there are certain things we can say. I mean, I think often in a class, you know, we don't normally have criminals come by. And when I talk about squad cars, look the way that they look, right? They're identifiable. That you know it's a police car. We don't have criminals come by and say, boy, I saw your squad car in the neighborhood. I didn't break into a house. They'll come run up to the PD to tell us that. You know? So it's a hard measure. There are some measurements there. I'll tell you that I'm looking into trying to get that stuff put in place for evaluation purposes. But it becomes tough. So the physical numbers on tickets and that type of sub arrest, you know, those are easy to count. But you know, there'll be a section somewhere.
But Chief, what
did you do?
Right, but I believe it's not that tough. And not to disagree with you, I understand what you're saying. But I think to me, it is really isn't that tough because if we say this area was absolute hell, but when Officer So and So went over there, the city council enjoys the crime drop. The chief enjoys the crime drop. So we got to say, but then, no, we got to say, why is that crime dropping? And then look at what officers work that beat also when that officer is off. If you see a drop when he or she is working after 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, but a same pace or greater when the other one is working, then we're not saying the other one is doing anything wrong. We got to say, what is this one doing that is working? And this is the sergeant's, the first line supervisor's responsibilities. what is this officer doing that obviously is working for the betterment of the community? Not the police department statistics, not the police department's grant, but for that community. And then what is this? What can this other officer do better? Can we link them up and put them in a car together? Let them ride and learn for each other. Maybe the other officer should write more tickets. Or maybe this other, you know.
And you're right. I mean, I wanted, you hit it exactly what I was going to say. You know, usually it's going to be, why is this area, why has there been a drop? What are we doing, right? If we don't know that we have an actual program in place where we have people doing certain things, but what is it that's made this happen? And, you know, like Joe said earlier, sometimes crime drops and it has nothing to do with the police. Right, so we have to look at that and be statistical about it. I want to just mention real quick. I'm gonna circle back on this ticket thing. I'm not opposed to riding side days. Trust me, there are people that deserve to get side.
Absolutely.
All right, but what the problem becomes if you look back and we talk about Ferguson, right? We talk about the Bureau of Justice going in and doing their study as Ferguson. One of the things that really jumped out, and I got this in the police chief's training, was the amount of citations for tickets that were written to that community.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost one. It was almost one ticket for every person that lives in that city. So you have the in that particular instance, you're basically building the tire keg to blow up, right? They're not moving violations. The majority of the citations were written in Ferguson. If you don't believe me, go look at the BTA study
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was pedestrian in the roadway.
Yep.
That was the majority of the tickets that were written. You know, pedestrian roadway where sidewalk was provided. So, you know, rather than get on the PA and say, get out of the road, you know, we actually made contact with people, wrote on these citations that we knew that they weren't going to pay, nor did they have the ability to pay,
mm-hmm.
right? Rather than fixing the problem
mm-hmm.
and dealing with it. And I say a roof sidewalk provided. I don't even know if that's a particular ordinance, but maybe they didn't have a sidewalk at first. Maybe that's why they were walking on their own way. But it is. They were picking on a particular set of people in Ferguson. If you don't believe me, go read it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a dynamic study that has already come out. It's already been pushed out and told. So, you know, the question came when they pushed this, and they asked about this, how many tickets do your community write? And the chief that was teaching this just randomly picked some people. And, you know, based on that size, we are about the size of Ferguson, right, my community. And he asked how many citations we wrote. I kind of guessed them, but roughly. And he said, then you're where you should be. It wasn't one for every 16,000 residents that I have. But there were citations that were written for moving violations and traffic violations. It intended to keep accidents from happening, because that's the reason for traffic enforcement, is to prevent accidents.
Yes.
Officers, I'm saying, am I wrong?
No.
That's what they're telling me, Cavier.
Well, yeah, you're right, but we, you know, without going down the rabbit hole, we also got to remember the 90s, once we discovered asset forfeiture and that we can make a whole lot of money. So, you know what I'm going to say? We can stop, if we stop enough of these people. And we're going to go there. These people, those brown and black people, those tan people, if we stop enough of them, eventually we'll get drugs, we'll take their car. And I'm not, you know, it's another can of worms. Even within traffic enforcement, and what municipalities do sometimes differs from what state does. Everybody wants money. They want the picture on Facebook looking at how much drugs we seize, and that's great. You're doing your job. You made an impact. But how many people's rights were violated? How much damage did you do to the reputation of police officers, the profession, the good officers, the good men and women who are out there busting their ass to do this job the right way every day, who have to deal with the Facebook insults, who have to deal with the unkind comment from a citizen? Not because that citizen knows that man or woman that's wearing that badge, but because of some jackass who has just blown up all of social media on something that he hasn't done for the first time. He just got caught, and it got put out there. And I think drug interdiction is what it's called. Is it needed? Yes. If we want to interdict it, they're interdicted from getting into the country. Stop pulling over every little citizen for whatever reason. Do you have drugs and guns and bombs? I'm not knocking people that have to do their job. But these are things that hinder good policing good problem-oriented policing, good community policing, trying to get the public to buy into that. In effect, the Green Book exists to a degree. I'll be honest with you. When I traveled with my wife from Waco, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia, not once but twice, I worried more about some of these cities and counties I was going through. At that time, I was still, you know, I was retired, but I'm a retired police officer. I didn't even take a gun with me. Driving from Waco, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia, I did not take my gun. Why? Because I was not going to be shot. Because my wife is white, that did not give me a pass. It made me more of a target. Alabama, Mississippi, that's real talk. But it's every day. Tony, come on, bro.
Well, I have to go kind of way back to what we were saying before. I'm going to say this, not to make a long soliloquy, but I love chocolate chip cookies, and I like tomatoes. No matter what I do, you can't squeeze a chocolate chip and get tomato juice. And what we've done is that, and Joe, I'm getting to a point, I see you frowning, but what I'm getting at is we stopped allowing police officers to be human. You know, when you talk about the community policing, anybody in law enforcement can tell you they can't do their job without partnership. And Stan has in the title, we're talking about the church. I'm just going to be a pastor who will take onus on this and say, we failed. We as a church body, we failed the community. We failed the police department. We failed. But the church has failed because the churches, and it doesn't matter if it's Episcopalian, Sanctified, Church of God in Christ, you know, Methodist, hey, who, Catholic, it doesn't matter. We failed. The churches and the community used to do two things. We moved into a community to give back and to do something you hardly hear about now. Starts with an O and ends with an H. It was called outreach. We used to do community outreach. We used to move into a community to make things better. The church used to be the mediator between the law enforcement and the community. And we helped. When the police couldn't, we paid for the food. And what lawyers have, and we've allowed lawyers, and that's not just the church, but society has allowed lawyers to stop police from being human. Yeah, Joe used to give me rides home at different times. And I loved it. Now, can you do that now? No. And it wasn't like, hey, I'm late, I want to ride home. It was because I'm on the CTA bus going home and somebody decides to bring marijuana on the bus and smoke it. The bus driver has an obligation to stop the bus, kick all of us off, call for the police. And Joe happened to be driving by in his car, seeing me walking and picked me up. Raining, snowing, it didn't matter. He would do that. But what you have now, you've got lawyers who would say, didn't Joe do something wrong? You got lawyers who are already waiting for restaurants to throw away bad food in the garbage and just at the off chance give bread that's about to go in the garbage to a homeless person and say, you know what, you gave that bread to that homeless person? Now, I'm going to defend the homeless person because they are now ill because of the bread. And we've allowed people to become numbers. About the tickets, writing so many tickets. Nobody is human anymore. Everybody wants to be a number, and those in leadership want numbers, and the church has failed. Law, well, I won't say the law, because the law was put there. Lawyers have failed. Politicians have failed. Can we put the toothpaste back in the tube? I'm a pastor, but I'm going to be kind of a realist. No. Now, to your point, Sarah, you know why that's not going to work now? Because churches are not looking for outreach. We as a church body and pastors, we're looking for what we can take from the community, not what we can give. And when you said that, hey, crime has gone down, the reason why we don't want to hear that is because who's going to get the credit? You're going to have pastors. You're going to have politicians. You're going to have chiefs. You're going to have governors who are going to be right there in the front of the line, in front of the media, trying to get credit for why crime is down.
That part.
Look at how, and I'll watch this. I just don't talk a lot about it because it happens every day. The next, and I don't want this to happen. In the name of Jesus, I don't want this to happen. But if the next
young black boy gets shot dead. Unarmed black boy gets shot dead at the hands of an officer. And it looks like on camera it was an unjustified shooting. Why she was going to be front and center? You ought to have people who have the title pastor, and mm-hmm. they'll be black. You ought to have lawyers who mm-hmm. have the title lawyer, but they can't practice law in a particular state.
Hello.
They'll be black, and they'll be front and center. And it's all due to, I want credit. I want media attention. I want money. Money has gotten out of control in this country. Many things have gone stale because of the love of the greed of money. And we're not going to be able to make people not want money anymore. So I'm going to end it right there because I want to hear your comments, but I want people hearing me to know, and this is really going out to Christians, because I'm not going to put another faith down to build my Jesus up, but Jesus did not let you down. Christ did not let you down. Christians let you down. That's why you are going to imitate Christ and not imitate Christians. So yes, we as a church of Jesus Christ, we let you down, law enforcement. We let you down, society. We don't do outreach. Some of us do, but a lot of us want the credit. We want the tithing. We want the offering, but we don't want to put in the work to give back. We just want to take it and get a bigger house, get a plane, get a beautiful car, go on beautiful vacations, and tell you, you can get the same thing if you give me all your money. Let that sink in. That's not even good economics, whether you're a Baptist, a Christian, an atheist, or a Satanist. Jesus said, when in business, be as men. And when he meant that, be professional, have a mind. You give all your money to somebody, but you're going to be blessed? How? I'm not saying not to give, but give with common sense he gave you. So, yes, Dan, I will be an apologist, a defender of the kingdom, but if we're wrong, we're wrong, and we stop doing outreach. We stop helping Chief. We stop helping you, Sam, in Waco. How many preachers came to your aid? We stopped being the mediators. We wanted to be the celebrities, and that's wrong. And it's going to stay wrong until maybe they decide, you know what, I have enough fame, I have enough money. But that's not going to happen because it's an increasing appetite that's never satisfied. And you only look at that when you have nothing. You know what? I can talk this way in case people are wondering, why is he talking this way? Because you know what? I learned a long time ago, with this COVID, I might never go back to another church building and depend on people to give me tithing and offering. My church is the world. My building is the internet. You don't like what I'm saying? I'm sorry. But I can back it up with scripture. And I don't have to worry about losing members. I'm pleasing the one who gave his life for me. And the least I can do is give my life to him. So, yes, as a church, we messed up. We let you down. And we have to get back to that place of being a mediator between the community and the police. Because, yes, we want to defend the police when they want to pay for this woman's groceries because she was shoplifting. But you can't do that now because of numbers. Why didn't she come to the church who's taking tithing and offering? Why didn't she come to the storehouse? You know, we have preachers who preach that verse about shall a man, shall God be robbed of tithes and offerings? But then you give your tithes and offering so the church can have a storehouse. How many churches have a storehouse for that woman to go to get her food, to get her clothes, to get baby formula, to get diapers? No. But they will be right there and say, here, donate. Click here to donate. If you don't give your tithes and offering,
But you know, Tony, I think, and before we belabor that point, good commentary. But I'm gonna tell you, I think that the church has lost its place, and don't be Facebooking me about what your church is doing. I'm just talking about the church, as far as from the black community stance perspective, you know, of what I've seen. You know, we live in the history of the transitional church. Everybody drives into the church in the hood and drives back out. And so, you know, I'm not knocking God. I'm just saying, you know, not all churches are like that. But in too many of these communities, many of the church folk are. And so I want to move in and transition into to get y'all's feelings and input and we'll go into my theory, the rats, the roaches, and the mice, and why that's in the picture. When I was given the worst neighborhoods in Waco as a community police officer in the 90s, murders were commonplace. I worked murders like burglar motor vehicles in some places and shootings. Not just me, the other officers did too. There were segments of that community, the city had absolutely given up on. They're not going to tell you they did, but they did. Because there were no sidewalks for these kids. There was nothing there environmental-wise. There's nothing there. Officers hated going over there. Nobody wanted to work these areas. And I lived in one of them, 1911 North 6th Street. I lived in the middle of Hell Central. I remember when Claire Crook was given a community policing project, and she did all the work, and she put this thing together, and she asked me to come on board, and I did. And she gave me these this list of neighborhoods. And I remember it's like the scene out of Lean on Me with Joe Clark. I was like, my God, why has thou forsaken me? I'm like, oh, my goodness. And I remember going into her office and saying, I got Brook Oaks. I got Carver, East Riverside, Landon Branch, North Waco, Cedar Ridge. You gave me Hell Central. And she said, yeah, I did. Claire was that way. She said, yeah, I did. She said, because these people need to see somebody who lives there with them, who knows what they're going through. And she said, and I know you. You'll do the work. I'm not going to have to ask you to do anything. You'll do it. And she believed in me. I got out there, and I remember I had an area that it was just inundated. Shootings, murders, drug dealers. They didn't care if you were a police car riding down the street. They'll stand up there and sell drugs right in front of you. And one night we had to write these monthly reports to all the city council members that knew everything I was doing in all six of my neighborhoods. What were the problems? What were your proposed solutions? How do you plan long administrative stuff that the average officer doesn't have to do? You work calls and you move on. And I remember going through all that, and one night I just had a headache, and I said, God, what do you want me to do? I can't fix this. We're raiding the same houses over and over and over again. Every time we raid a house, it's open next week with a bunch of new knuckleheads in there. Nothing is working. The government doesn't have an answer. The city doesn't have an answer. And the police department doesn't have an answer. And I live here, and I see it all the time, and I'll be damned if I know. And I'm going to tell you, God told me, he said, what are the people asking you to do? Not the police department, not the city council, not your commander. What are the people saying to you? And you know what the people were telling me? Get rid of it. Not make a bunch of arrests. Not seize a bunch of money. Hello, asset forfeiture fans. Not put the police department on the front page. Not promote the city of Waco. They were saying, I want to go to bed without gunshots. I want to go to bed without loud music. So I went out. I picked a geographic area in one neighborhood. And I looked at it for a week, and then I went around the following week, and I passed out a flyer to every house in a four-block radius, including the drug house. Neighborhood meeting, this time, this place, this is what we're going to talk about. And when we got in that room, I didn't care if you're a preacher, poor person, politician, black, white, I know so-and-so on the city council, Stan gives a damn less. And I said, okay, we're going to clean this up. The key word is we, not Stan. Stan don't live here. You live here. We're going to do it. And I had written down five things that on a board that the police department saw as problems. And we typically, as police, burglaries, murders, assaults, prostitution, gambling, whatever, we bring our statistics and we put them up there. My eye-opening was when I asked the citizens, what is your number one? It wasn't murder. It wasn't even the gunshots. Their number one concern for me, in order for the police department to prove itself, or Stan to prove himself, and then by virtue of Stan, the police department, help us with our number one. Theirs was loud music. Now, that sounds crazy to people. Folks are being murdered. Drugs are being sold, but they're worried about loud music. Their kids being able to get some sleep before going to school was important to them. So I helped them with their number one. They helped me with my number one. And we crisscrossed back and forth. And I'm learning as they're learning. But the key to it was what I quickly noticed. It said no matter what the police department did, no matter how much resources the city would dump in or give me to attack these problems of so-called crime, the alleys were still overgrown. Trash everywhere, junk cars on the street. These people had not seen a fork in East Waco. In some places, four blades of grass was a forest. Generations of looking out the front window and seeing dirt. So what did we do? We got with Lowe's. We got with Home Depot. We partnered with these. They came out and taught a Saturday class, how to grow a lawn, how to take care of a lawn. We didn't even deal with crime. And these people went out after the meeting. We killed up everybody's lawn. You know, we went out there and taught them how to grow grass. A couple months later, they see grass. This is when everybody cuts it. Now they're looking out their window and no longer dreaming of hitting a lotto to move to this place across town. They're seeing across town where they are. Their property value is going up. They're investing in their community. I'm not doing it. They're doing it. And I give them the credit. But the rats, the roaches, and the mice, the three things that plague neighborhoods. Your roaches. Anybody's ever had a roach in their house, and folks don't act like you pure, you didn't have them. A roach is not going to hurt you. What a roach will do is come out when company's there and embarrass you. What the roach represents from Stan's philosophy of the rats, roaches, and mice, the prostitute, the neighborhood drunk, the pain in the neck person who's not an immediate threat to you, but they're embarrassing when you have company. When you ignore that roach long enough, then you get mice. If you've ever had a mouse in your house, you'll never see the mouse. You see the shredded paper. You see their droppings. You see evidence of them, but not them. Those are your car burglars. Those are your house burglars, the people you never see, but you see their aftermath. When you ignore them, then you get rats. And the rats are your felons, your violent offenders. These are people who, if you look at your city and your place as a building, each neighborhood is a different room in that building. A building is held up by an infrastructure. These rats navigate throughout your house by the existing beams. These are repeat offenders who just prey on neighborhoods because they know the legal system. They move through it. They carry more disease. The rat carries more disease than the mice does or the roach, and will fight you and attack you. So how do we deal with crime? People say, well, how does this all relate? It relates because I didn't even deal with the crime. My first 2 months in that neighborhood, I didn't deal with the crime. I dealt with these people's environment, their living conditions. So what did we do? We literally got rid of those who had mice and those who had rats and roaches, the real ones, by changing their living conditions and giving them a different view out their front door. Their personality changed. Their way of living changed, but it also impacted crime because the drug dealers and the prostitutes were now staying on the manicure law. They went somewhere else. Police didn't even have to deal with them. We didn't have to deal with them over there. They naturally went somewhere else. And what did? We empowered these people. We raised their property value. We taught them to believe in themselves and not the city doing it for you or the police department doing it too. For you. And to the police department, we gave the people the credit, not the chief, not Stan, not the city council, not the city of Waco, because the city of Waco provided dumpsters when I need them. But guess what? Those people paid taxes to have those dumpsters there. So they didn't do no favors. But the people who dug out the sidewalks and the old folks who couldn't dig out the sidewalks but said, I'll cook while y'all do the block party painting the house. What did it do? It brought other officers who didn't know about community policing, but they came over to see what Stan's doing, what's going on. And people came up and met them. Hey, how you doing? So where they used to get cussed out, now people are going, hey, man, glad you're here. How you doing? I'm so-and-so. That's the rats, the roaches, and the mice in a nutshell of what I actually apply, and I believe in, and I know to this day work, which is in my autobiography, which is coming up. Floor is open.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a bomb right there.
Yeah.
Oh, I gotta do that. Man, okay. Go ahead.
So, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I just gotta say something. Stan, don't fade out now. Where everybody gets you. amen to your sermon on the mount just now. I thought it was it's right. But let me throw a couple of things at you guys. When we talk about the religious part, I would ask anyone on this feed, where do your preachers live at? Do they live in a neighborhood that they sermonize, for bad, lack of a better term? Do they live? Do they breathe? Do they put in the work that they talk about? See, and that's my problem. Because it's easy to castigate, to talk about, but you're not part of the solution. You're part of the solution when you put the work in, when you live and breathe that same community, which is community policing. And at this point, we, as a people, black folks, have to start doing our own community policing. At some point, we have to wake up and do for self. You know, we talk about, you know, Tony started talking about, you know, if the next black boy gets killed by the police, I agree totally with you, and we know who you're talking about. But what about the black boy gets killed by the black boy? That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, amen.
That's what I'm doing. Every day I go to my job, I got a murder. I mean, think about that. Think about that. Now, we want to castigate the police.
Mm-hmm.
What about us?
Say it again, Joe. Say it again for the folks in the back.
It stood with me or Devlin or Stan, even you, Tony. Stood with you and said, hey, you got to cut this shit out, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
Let's call it what it is. Pardon my term, call a spade a spade.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, if we're going to get serious about it, let's put the blame. We've always talked about, I wish Izzy was here, because I have something to do. We always put the blame on others when a lot of that blame is self-inflicted. Some of this stuff is self-inflicted. I'm not worried about, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's no question that the police or law enforcement has become out of control. But look at the statistics. Who's killing whom? Where I'm working at right now, I don't have a white officer. They're not killing these kids. Pookie is. Pookie's killing the shit out of them. I mean, we had a murder of a rapper, I think we talked about, of a rapper's brother. I've got 27 murders across the city related to one homicide. Black on black. It wasn't a police officer. Again, it doesn't excuse what the police have done, the law enforcement stuff. But we have to get back to what are we doing?
So you're right. No, black lives only matter when white people kill a black life. You see that narrative that has been formed, that you see it continued, you know, in the media, whether it's the right wing or the left wing, doesn't matter. You know, it sends a very bad message. Hey, I like how Ruby said, you know, we kill each other off, and then we get mad when others do it. Yeah, we do. Look, I'm black. I can take Pookie killing my cousin. But here it is. Chief, don't you shoot my cousin, because now all hell gonna break loose. What kind of insanity is that? And, you know, that just makes me think that we've got it wrong, where it's not life matters. It's only what I find the narrative to matter. So, you know, you're completely right. You know, I mean, what do you do with your situation, Joe, where you have no white officer, but you have to deal with the fact that black is killing black? And that's a narrative that black people don't want to talk about, because what it does, unfortunately, it feeds that narrative from the white supremacists who say, well, how come you don't talk about black-on-black crime? Well, because when we do, then you get all excited about it, and yeah, we can't push the narrative of the white killing the black. And then, you know what you have? You have a dog chasing his tail, and nothing gets done. So I feel for you.
You know, Tony, and if I can say to all the officers listening, who will listen to this, or who will troll it, or sit around a water cooler, I'm just going to say from my personal experience, and I have a very diverse Facebook following. I don't just have a bunch of afros and pick in the back of my hair and black fist up in the air. I don't have all that. People that are on my post know me, and I respond to them, they know me. But if I could say this to all the officers, two things. Number one, the average community, contrary to the videos and what you see, they don't care whether you're a black officer or a white officer. So much as they care is that they know you. Having a presence in that community and being open to dialogue and understanding, I have seen more, my experience, folks in Waco get mad at me, I don't care. I've seen more white officers in East Waco, predominantly black. And the folks in East Waco, and they're on my timeline, those folks love those white officers, not because they were white, but because guess what they did? They got out the car and talked to them. They sat down and said, how you doing? They went to some, and I'm not saying the black officers aren't doing it, but what I am saying is being black and an officer is not going to give you a pass card. I'm sorry, you're not getting that. Not here on this show. If you don't have an identity in that neighborhood, I say this term all the time, you don't have skin in the game, being black and being angry is not enough for me.
Can I add something to that?
Come on, John.
Look at the term community policing. Mm-hmm. People use that as a singular term.
Mm-hmm.
Community slash police.
Thank you.
And that's where people get confused at. It's not a singular. It's a plural.
And you know what else it isn't, Joe? It's not the community you choose. And some people are so caught up in being the police that they don't even know who the hell Sir Robert Peel is anymore.
Oh, please.
Sir Robert Peel is to policing what Jesus is to Christianity, what Muhammad is to Islam. All you officers, go read it, check it out, suck it up, because that is the way it is. And that's what we talk about on this show. But until officers get out of the car and understand two things. Sir Robert Peel said, it is not incumbent upon the community to respect the officer. It is the officer's responsibility to earn that community's respect. That's number one. And number two, your ass went home, not because of the tactical rifles you got, not because of your bulletproof vest, not because how great you are. You went home, and John said it last week, because that community allowed you to.
Sam, let me ask you a question. Is that taught in the academy, and is that taught by veteran officers when you have a rookie come on the force? Because a rookie is going to hear what they learned in the academy and what the veterans that they're riding with. Who is telling that officer?
Tony, I'll tell you this. When these young officers are in the FTO program, they're open to everything. They're not going to disagree with you or question you, yes or yes, because they want to get through and make the team. And I'm going to let the chief chime in on this, but I'm going to tell you something. I don't know how many times I've watched these little kids, and I'm calling them kids figuratively, get through their probation period. Now, they come out on the street, day one of I don't know shit, and nobody here looks like me, and they know everything. And that veteran officer, whether he is black or white or male or female or gay or straight or whatever, oh, that's an old schooler. That's old time. I'm going to do it my way. Why? Because they're sitting on the afternoon shift. For everybody who don't know, day shift is usually your veteran officers. Midnight is your transition officers. Some veterans like me to say, I just prefer to stay out of everybody's administration's way. I don't want to deal with them. And then you got your afternoon shift where all the rookies get done. And if you're an afternoon sergeant anywhere in America, listen to what I'm saying, you're going, he damn right, because I hate getting a shitload of rookies, you know, every couple months. But so you got a guy that's been on his own for 10 minutes, listening to a guy that's been on his own for a year,
right,
teaching him. So by the time he gets to midnights, before he can get to day shift, he's so jacked up and messed up. Whether that other person is black or white doesn't matter. These young kids on the afternoon shift don't want to listen to the vet. Why do you see so many veteran officers getting out of policing? It's not because they don't like citizens. It's not because they don't like helping people. They're sick of the politics. They're sick of this new breed. I got it. I got to act. I know how to do this. I know better than you. And that is what is killing policing. Go ahead, Chief.
Go ahead. Everything you said is spot on. I love the idea of the roaches, the mice, and the rats. I mean, you would be surprised the amount of problems that can be solved, that crime problems that can be solved by things that are not crime.
Mm-hmm.
that they're not crime related.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we've done this before in our own communities where, you know, you keep talking, multiple times we talk about the sidewalks. I mean, how important is the sidewalk?
Mm-hmm.
Well, most people are like, really not that big a deal. It's a huge deal in some communities. The grass, manicured the lawns, the houses that are in disrepair, getting them fixed, having people show up and do that. But let's be real, like we always are on this show. You know, crime is not going to go away. There's always going to be crime. We can reduce it, but you'll never eliminate it. Some of these are the tactics that we use to put in place to fix a lot of these problems. But there has to be that real conversation on both ends when you do meet with the community members to tell them, hey, if this doesn't get straightened up, we are going to start arresting people.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have crime.
Absolutely.
We can't have the dope dealers. We can't have the murders. Folks are going to go to jail. We need your help. We need your help to do it. You know, so getting the word out, and just like Joe was saying, you know, sometimes we have to, you know, in our communities, we've got to police our own. You know, getting that stuff straight, getting people lined up and say, look, this, we're not going to have this anymore. Again, it ends up being the citizen that says, look, this is the end of this. We're not doing this anymore. We're fixing it. We're going to make it better. So, you know, it's a package deal, and it's a team effort. This is not just one side that can fix these problems. You know, when you talk about the officers that are leaving, and I just saw an article before we got on about in Texas, they're having hell trying to hire people.
Mm-hmm.
We just can't get anybody. So, I mean, it's going to be an issue that we're losing these veterans and the experience. You know, how are we as administrators going to have to deal with this? But, you know, the FTO program, you know, that's got to be a component of it. You've got to be getting out of car campus with people. You're going to have to get out and make changes with folks. That's the only way any of this stuff gets fixed or gets done.
But, Chief, let me ask you a question. From and I want to speak for the people who are listening and the ones that are on Facebook. But from your perspective, and I want to go to Joe and then Stan, because I really want to get your perspective. What, name one thing we can do as John and Joan Q. Public, and Chief has the IT issue. So, Joe, you know, because you're current, Stan, because you have a lot of knowledge of being, you know, former, just name one thing, whether it's on the law enforcement side, whether it's on the public side, you know, even if you want to just, here's one thing you can do, those who are law enforcement, here's one thing you can do to help as a regular citizen. It's just, you know, giving a list is going to be good, but people can get overwhelmed. So I'm just curious, from what you look at day-to-day, Joan, what is one thing somebody in law enforcement can do? Just give us one homework assignment in law enforcement, and give people like me and the people who are looking for that in law enforcement, give us just one homework assignment we can do for this next week, and then Stan, you give us homework.
You know what, Tommy, I'm glad you asked that. Let me say this. The best example of what can be done in law enforcement is you. You're reminded of your work, and I admit it. So you tell me what I did right and straight back.
Okay.
You know, Tony, I think for me, as far as law enforcement, the best thing you can do for law enforcement is before you apply for law enforcement, whatever God you pray to, I don't care if it's a rock, Satan, whatever it is, you need to make sure this is what you want to do. We have the highest suicide rate of any profession. Not because of calls on the street. Joe's not putting a gun to his head because he's working murders. It's because of the internal crap that we have not cleaned in our house. I'm not going to go into details about it. I've mentioned it on the show. We all know where I'm going. It's because of the politicians who meddle in me as an officer on the street, doing my job on the street, not on paper. Hello, somebody. It's that one. We carry all that. Let me finish before Joe real quick. We finish all that. And then to the citizens, I don't care if that officer is black, white, male, female. You don't know that. Try to get to know that. Not all of them are bad, but unfortunately, by the nature of the work we do, we come in contact with good people at a bad moment, the kindest way I could say it, but we come in contact with a lot of assholes. I work midnight, whether they're that way because they're drunk. That is a fact. So I think that if you're an aspiring officer, want to be an officer, before you take this job and live with the nightmares that 20, 25, Joe's situation, 30-some years, the chief, 26, before you want those nightmares in your head forever, you need to make sure you're built for the job, because if you ain't built for it, you're going to hurt a lot of people along the way. Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry, bro.
No, I just wondered, you hit something 2 days ago this came out from, I believe it was DOJ, Chicago police right now, as of 2 days ago, is the highest suicide rate of law enforcement in the country. In fact, it's 64% higher, listen to what I just said, 64% higher than the normal. Now, I would suggest this also, that the people coming in should be given a writing assignment. Why do you want to be the police? I think it would be behoove us as an employer. Now, certainly, you know, there's some people that have exposure to all these nonprofits and all that. There's some people that want to do it. So I think we should give a writing segment, just like they do in law school.
Mm-hmm.
We have to give a written application. Why do you want to go to law school? Why do you want to be the police?
You know, Joe, I love that, bro, because you opened up another can. We got time. We're going to go down this trail because you brought up a good point. We kind of do. Not the way, and I know I agree with what you're saying, but we kind of do. It's called an application. But the problem comes, then we get to these interview boards. Let's go there for a minute. Let's talk about these interview boards. That is the final step. These are the men and women who sit on the board, yay or nay, whether you get accepted or whether you don't. How many of these applicants come through there and their dad works there, their mom works there, their cousin works there, their sister, their brother, their cousin, their mom, and the goldfish is in the chief's office? Okay, how much of that bullshit is there? How much of it is objective board members who look and need to say, well, this guy's black, so we're going to hire him, or this guy's a good old boy, so we're going to hire him? See, all, and I'm talking about board members now, and these are men and women, a small select group of people in every police department, who have been entrusted to make that final recommendation to the chief for final approval. How much do we bet these people? And then once again, I got to go back to what I've always said. How much do we involve the community in the hiring process? I should be able, and I was a board member for about 12 years. Stan should be able to walk into that interview, and Tony's coming in there. I ought to be able to first open up that folder that has the civilian review board and read how they felt about you. They're not going to know the questions that Stan or the chief or none of us will ask, but I get a feel for them. Then I interview, you know, we go around the board and we do our standardized questions. And then I'm able to not only make an assessment from Stan as a patrol officer, because the person we're hiring is going to be out on the streets with Stan and other people like Stan for 5 years before they can apply for anything. So I represent all the men and women on the street and the community. So we got you're 1,000% right. But I'm saying let's not put the interview boards let's not exclude them either. We got to do better at maybe we got to move some people around the board. Maybe not that they're not doing a good job, but we've outgrown what you're bringing. And we need to go a little bit bigger.
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you know, in the hiring process, if you start thinking about hiring law enforcement, you're talking about 20, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
potentially having that employee. So you've got to get it right the first time. So the effort that you put forth at the beginning is so important, absolutely so important. Because there's a certain window there that if they don't make it, the probationary period that they can be let go. If you have in the right make wrong guess, if your color is starting to come out and you see some major deficiencies that you don't want, then you gotta let them go. But I agree with you, Stan. I agree with Joe. I like the idea of writing something. I'm kind of a big fan. I'll go back.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite topic, emotional intelligence. I'm trying to figure out how to put that in the entry level screen I think I got a good measure. My last training class that I went to, I met with a consultant who measures emotional intelligence. And so we're going to connect here in the next couple of weeks to see what I can do to maybe impact that and put that into the hiring process. But the review board is an interesting topic. You know, of course, being a smaller agency, you know, our nepotism policy is probably one of the strongest you've ever probably seen. I don't think OPD, Chicago PD definitely couldn't get away, and my PD could get away with that. But basically, if you're, I think, the third degree of continuity, you can't work for us. I mean, that's, you know, you can't work anywhere in the city. So it's pretty strong. I have my opinions on both sides of that. But the review board that we have, I think it's important to rotate different members through. Ours typically is made up of seven people headed by the assistant chief of police. You know, you don't see me. I see you when you pass. I welcome you for coming in. But you don't see me again until a conditional job offer.
That's right.
You've gone through all these processes and these steps. I need my department, my organization to tell me this is the right person. And you know, there are field training officers that are on there. There are supervisors that are on there. There may be a detective. The makeup is of all genders, all races. You name it. They just get thrown in there. And so the questioning also becomes important. I have a specific set of questions that I stole from a long time ago. But, you know, it's not the old, okay, you're training off your skills in Snicker bars. So
yeah.
You know, it's not that. It's more thought-provoking. I just love the idea about the right assignment. I think that's fantastic. It tells quite a bit about a person. But again, I'm going to go back and say, you got to spend the effort up front. I mean, significant amount of effort up front who you're going to hire. I don't care where you're at or what agency you're in. If you're just, you know, fly by night picking people because they have a heartbeat and they can be commissioned by the certain state they live in, you're doing it wrong. I will tell you, a former city manager of mine, he used to be like, man, come on, we got these spots. We got to pick it up. You know what? The problem is if we mess this up, this is something for life. This is something we've got running around our department for life that has the potential to do more harm because of one single incident than anything we could ever conjure up. So let's put forth the effort in the beginning to get the right people and then grow them as we move on. You know, I'm going to shut up just a second, but we talk about the suicide issue, getting them in there, having them set up for success to begin with, and then growing and assisting them throughout their career. This is where I see that these problems are coming in with the suicide rates within our agency, is we do it. It's not a one and done. You can't just hang them on, good job, we love to have you come in. This is something you have to cultivate. It's the same idea with the roaches, the mice, and the rats.
Exactly.
You know, we talk about putting these things in neighborhoods to fix these problems. It doesn't stop when we put the sidewalk in and we fix, you know, somebody's home. There's follow-up to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got to show back up the next week and knock on the door. Hello? How are things going? What else are we doing? That's the issue. We cannot let lose sight that it's not one and done. This is a continual effort that will never stop. So, when you think it's, oh, we're going to throw this program in, and, it's a good deal. And I'm going to give a shout-out to Waco, because they've got a program that's going on with a lot of the offenders, the constant, I call them problem children in their community, the ones that they go out to all the time. They're arresting them throughout the year, multiple times, 30, 40 times a year. They have a program that they put in place, which I'm very interested in. I'm going to steal some of their stuff. But it's causing a problem of this person's issue. You know, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever, right? They've got one really good success story that they put out on the news, but they continue to follow up with this guy to make sure he's still following the right path.
And you know, Chief,
and
to the credit of the department, you know, I know the guy that runs that program, always a good guy.
Yeah.
But it took him and people like him and some leadership that believed in him to say, we need to do this. It doesn't matter whether it makes Waco PD look good, whether it's going to make the city look good. It is what these officers need to get the stress off of them and to help the citizen.
Yeah, and it solved the problem.
Absolutely.
It solved the problem. Now, just because you solved the problem at the forefront doesn't mean it won't come back. That's why I go back. I'm going to say there is a consistent and continual follow-up that you have to stay on top of and check in, right? And if you're not doing that, then you're not doing it right.
Because the problem is going to come back. It's going to come back in another person. But when it does, guess what? Not now. And this is what I did in Naples. Now, not only do you have a viable, workable, proven solution, but instead of you being the head spear, you can refer them to that person,
right,
and then you become a supplement. Let me interject this, because Ruby Allen said something, and I always want to pay more attention to the Facebook. I got to get better at that. And she said, how can police departments weed out bad cops, which makes it hard for the good ones? My answer, and Joe, I'm going to come to you right after me. My answer is quite simple. I said the George Floyd bill that is out there wavering in the wind for whatever reason, hasn't passed, taking a back seat to everything else. But my answer is this. The first thing I felt should have been added to the George Floyd bill is whistleblower protection for all state, county, and municipal officers on par with what that which feds enjoy. Then officers are free to speak. The second thing was free mental health for all police officers. I think if you allow officers to be able to speak without having to go through some of the stuff that I know I went through, you allow them to speak, I think that it would make it a lot better to weeding out the bad ones. Joe?
Well, let me add, I'm glad you brought that up because I was about to hit you on that anyway. I think that in the agency I work for now, we do this thing called lateral hires. But as the chief alluded to, in law enforcement across this country, it cannot keep up with attrition. It just is not. Nobody wants to be in the police anymore because of what they see happening. So the other problem is not keeping or getting new ones, but getting rid of the rats. We've got to stop the decertification process, and particularly when we bring laterals. I just had a couple of guys, again, in my system, they were let go by the agency. But because we're in such a poor position, I had people wanting to push these guys through. One guy had all kinds of stuff in the background, so the other guy. I put the hammer down, and he didn't get the job. But had someone else been in my position, they would hire him. So we take somebody else's crap, and we bring them into our situation. So you're adding gasoline to the fire.
Amen.
So the first thing is get the decertification process up and running. Some of these guys should never, ever be the police anywhere in this country.
They shouldn't even be allowed to have a fishing rod.
Once we get that right, I guarantee we'll start attracting a better candidate.
Joe,
they know they were serious.
We're going to do that show. We're absolutely, I'm glad you introduced that. We're going to do that show, and I got a title, unless y'all give me a better one. Is your department a wrecking yard? Are you just collecting jalopies, relics, and accidents from every place else, hoping you can recycle them?
I love that. Even make it sound a little worse than what Joe's talking about. So I just went through with the state of Texas. Right, on lateral officers. Now, in Texas, I love this idea. I think it's great. Our regulatory agency people, when you do backgrounds, you actually have to sign now, officially sign in the background packet that you viewed that person's personnel file, right? Mm-hmm. That you went and actually laid eyes on it and said, hey, this guy's a good candidate or gal's a good candidate for our agency, right, or not. Oh, man, that's fantastic. That's awesome. And so it's that the city two down from a larger North Texas agency that hires people from out of state all the time. Their agency stand, he says, hey, director, I'm just going to ask you this because, you know, we're hiring people from NYPD, Chicago, right? This is a very affluent agency in North Texas. They do get officers. But when we call them to look at their background package, they say, oh, you can't just eat, but we don't even let you look at their evaluations. So I sign off as the chief of police to say that this is a qualified candidate, when I can't even go to the home agency and look at their stuff because of collective bargaining, because of the contracts and things that they have set in place. I until we can fix this thing nationally, because I'm kind of crazy in Texas, so I'm not one of them. If I get somebody from out of state, it's kind of uncommon. But even the larger agency, Waco PD, they have a tendency to hire folks from out of state. And I know they picked up a couple NYPD people that decided to move to Texas. So there's some issues there. There's a lot of secrecy that's being held that you can't make an informed decision. I've been through that background process, and then kind of the ins and outs and the right releases to get both your personnel file and your chief's file. I mean, I can get all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So especially here in Texas, so you make sure that you have the right candidate available. But that becomes problematic, and until the nation gets that way, you know, we're gonna continue having these issues. I mean, I've been in that position where Joe's been, and you're having to try to get people on the street. But I will tell you, I'll tell anybody listening to this feed, I'll work short. I, as your chief, will go work deep.
Absolutely.
Rather than hiring a third, because I'm telling you,
absolutely,
this is a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit waiting to happen.
You know, chief, I think the profession needs to understand two words, and I'm not a lawyer. But I know these two words, and every police officer better understand them, and the chiefs and city managers better damn sure understand them. Vicarious liability. You better know those two words, because the public hasn't learned that term yet. For those of you who don't know, vicarious liability, look it up. Because if that was commonly known, there'd be a hell of a lot of lawsuits, and you know what? It wouldn't just be officers.
One of the questions is on all of our supervisory interview panels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I could be a chief somewhere. I could have been a chief.
Please define and give four examples of vicarious liability.
Could I have been a chief somewhere?
hey, so the first time we did it, I got this. I said, you know what? And so you walk around the offices, and you'll see the fix. Vicarious liability issues posted. They're on their desk.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know what? That's important. It's big. It's super important.
Mm-hmm. Tony.
You know, well, I want to say this much. I want to say that from the standpoint of what you guys are really saying, you know, especially when I was going around asking you guys to give homework assignments, I just want to say I really hope that the people listening and watching are really hearing this and can do something, because it's like Joe was saying, it does start with us. And to Stan's point, you have to get to learn an officer has to get to learn the community. And I'll just say one thing as a man of faith, and just as a human period, if I give you one homework assignment, just say hello. It won't cost you anything. No one is saying you got to buy this off of the coffee. No one is telling you you have to go and hug him. You know, it's not about the faith. I say this humbly, and I also say it because I don't like admitting to it, but I've got more friends that I can talk to who are not Christians. I know the Bible says that Jesus was a friend of sinners, and I'm trying to imitate Christ, but I don't want to really imitate him in that way. But there are many people of faith who don't agree with me, who really just think that, you know, this is a black and white issue, who some believe that, you know, that there are a great amount of people who are going to hell for whatever reason. I won't get into the theology of our debates, but I will tell you, nothing can beat just saying hello to anybody, be it police, be it somebody white, be it somebody black, be it somebody in that line in front of you, behind you. You never know who is dealing with and contemplating taking their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And just by you turning around and saying, hello, how are you today? I'm okay, thank you. Well, good, I'm glad you're here. And then just turn back around and go back to what you're doing. You have no idea the prescription, the medicine you just gave that person to take just one more day and say, maybe it's not that bad. You have no idea that person, an officer, a nurse, a judge, who they are. Every one of us is walking around with an under construction sign around our necks. None of us are perfect. Not one of us. I don't care how many times you may see certain people on television, they all have it together. Everybody is under construction. So the police need us. And police, you need us. We need each other.
And we will do better. We'll get there. So just do one thing. You hear these men talking. Just say hello to somebody today as you go out. Just tell somebody, hello, I'm glad you're here, and go on. Thanks, man.
Okay, let me do this in the interest of time. We're at the 20-minute mark. And, you know, Tony, you mentioned now three times homework, which I think is very relevant because we all need to learn. And we're going to just take a minute and give everybody their time to say what they want to propose as a homework problem, not just to the people in Facebook and Waco and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania and Atlanta and all of us. That's here. Appreciate you guys. Love it. Share it. Everything we do is free. You can share it, cut it up, do whatever you want to do with it. It's out there. But I want to say, for me, for Stanford Homer, I got to go back to my dream of what I saw as retirement. And I actually never saw myself retiring. I used to have a reoccurring nightmare of being shot and being in a hospital looking at my life playing out on a wall at 3 in the morning, you know. But I made it to retire, and I think for me, my biggest fear was that I would retire, and the moments where you go through your career and you look back, you saw where you put somebody in jail because they made you mad. You saw where you wrote somebody that ticket because they made you mad. You saw when you did something to somebody because they made you mad. I think for me, the solace is I just did the job. And I think, so I would say homework is look in that mirror, not Republican or Democrat or black or white, because you ain't looking at nobody but you. You can't lie to you. And ask yourself, am I the best I can be and how do I get better? Not for Facebook, not for the world, but you. Whatever small thing that's important to you, not your mama, your husband, your wife, but you, to make you look at you tomorrow better. That's me. That's how I do things. I'm not saying it's perfect for everybody. But I would say for homework, just go look in the mirror. Don't say nothing. Don't think nothing. Don't have no music playing. Don't have your phone in there. Don't be trying to pose and look cute. In fact, do it when you wake up before you go to bed when you're at your worst. And see who you really are. And see what you need to work on. That's mine. Whoever wants to go next. Joe, come on.
I got lots of homework for people. I think when we have this discussion, it's come up multiple times just today. This is a two-way street. This is not just the police. This is the community as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my homework assignment for you is, listen, regardless of where you're at, just go to your police department. I mean, you go meet those people or call them out. You know, go to their community then. Do something. But it's never, your problems are never going to get fixed if you're not all on the same page. From my personal experience, I try like heck to meet everybody. I love meeting people. I think what Tony said was pretty powerful. Say hi. Just say hello to somebody. I love it when somebody says hi to me. You may not get away from that. Maybe just with you for the rest of the day. But I mean, I'm telling you from the officer perspective, that means the world. I mean, Sam, Joe, tell me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. When somebody says, hey, how are you doing? I appreciate what you're doing. Thank you. That changes them. That can change your whole day. But get to know your police department. There are thousands of agencies across this country that are doing really good stuff. Citizens Police Academies, National Night Out events. You know, go to those things. Get to visit people. Have the opportunity to find somebody in uniform. And it doesn't have to be anybody with stars or bars, or, you know, anything on there. Just talk to me. I've got these problems in my neighborhood. What do you think we should do? And that's how this whole thing starts. You know, I'll say one of the most popular, this is crazy, but one of the most popular things I've got going on right now, I've got a radar trailer. Right? You see them on the side of the road, you know, it tells you how fast you're going. We're deploying that thing everywhere. Somebody calls, hey, we got speeders in the neighborhood. You know what? I got a solution for a radar trailer. People love that thing. Right? It helps statistical analysis for us to find out if we do have speakers or there's traffic issues, things, you know, but that's a great little piece of equipment. People call me all the time, hey, chief, or they send messages on Facebook, hey, chief, we got these issues. I don't want to send the radar trailer up. You know, but it's that stuff. Having the ability and the connection me and the call the police department and say, these are the things we have going on in our neighborhood. We need to get these addressed. We need those. Right? We may not have all the answers, and we certainly don't have all the resources because, you know, we just don't. But a lot of agencies are super creative at coming up with things to fix issues. And again, this is a, when we talk about the premise of this program, you know, this is not just the police department. This is the entire state, the community, public works. You know, I can't put a sidewalk down, but I can try. But I can get people that can do. Right, or we can fund it through the city itself. But get to know your police department, get to know your officers, go visit with them, and sometimes just say hi. It may make the world a difference talking to that officer, but it creates that contact, that one-on-one contact. I'll shut up with this last thing. You're more likely, and I think even people on the show, you're more likely to contact me and ask me questions on how to fix a problem because simply you know me.
Mm-hmm.
You know me from being on you. And so we have learned that when you know an officer, you recognize them, you know their name, and they know you, you're more likely to contact that officer and solve those problems, regardless of what the issue may be. Again, to the citizen, if it's something that happens to them, it's probably the worst thing that's happened to them all day. And we know that. So we have to deal with it that way. We have to deal with it effectively. But homework, get to know your PD. If they don't come out to you, you go out to them. But certainly, if they put on any type of events, show up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't cost anything. Just show up and visit. That's my homework for everyone.
Amen. Joe?
Certainly, I can't disagree with anything I said, but me being management now.
Traitor!
In my jurisdiction, I take a different approach. I have to know the people so I get out. I've done it. And here's the thing. My agency doesn't have enough cars. So I have to run around in my own car. But the,
wow.
But the, it's, the uniqueness of what we do is just that. But fairness is something that kind of touched the nerve. I think all policemen work their way at some point have a death drain.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have had this. Jim, I know you had it, but I can see it. Unfortunately, it's part of good policing. That's not crazy, but it is a part of it. Oftentimes, I've thought about, you know, how am I going to explain? You know, you have a dream of how do I explain this to my wife?
Mm-hmm.
My sister.
You just don't.
You don't. So there's a lot of things that we collectively talk about that nobody's ever going to know. And we've said this before, even to this day, the stuff that I don't talk about, with nobody else would understand it but us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. So that being said, going back to the homework assignment, I would suggest, as the chief of staff and Tony talked about or alluded to, find out who that chief is. Find out who management is. Patrolmen, at this point, in most places, and I guarantee you what's happening here in the city of Chicago, what's happening in Texas, the reality is that they're being worked to death.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have the latitude, they don't have the discretion, and they certainly don't have the bosses with the balls to make the call.
Bad part.
You know, Devlin, I've read some of this stuff. I've got nothing to praise for this guy. I wear stand stuff, and I know what Tony does. So it's incumbent to find that candidate that would rather ask for forgiveness than beg for permission. And everybody here. And that's what makes real policing, because everything we do, when you look at the laws in this country, most of them came about from a police act. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Donna versus Moran versus Arizona. Escobedo versus Illinois, Terry versus Ohio. It was a police act. Right, wrong, and different, but it will. The other thing is this. We look at the level of people that distrust the police because of one encounter.
Mm-hmm.
All it takes is one encounter to turn the citizen against your butt.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes the good officer anywhere from 10 to 20 times to come back one fuck up.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we got to go back and cover that one because that one kid will be what will break this whole thing wild. To break this whole off.
Before we get out of here, I got to end with some profound words. You know, somebody once said that, you know, once you change your attitude, you change your philosophy. Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought process. Once you change your thought process, it changes the way you behave. And then you can move into action at that point. And that's not the quote directly, but it's the basis of it. You know, but that's a profound quote that is more relevant today than it ever was. Change who you are and how you think before you act. And that quote came, ladies and gentlemen, from Malcolm X. I will post the original quote up on my page for those who don't believe that he did it. Which, side note, and aside, that's why we need to teach critical race theory. Because we all learn something new. But anyway, Keith, come on.
My last thing, you know, I talk a lot about homework because there's a story that I was told about homework, and many of you probably heard this story, but there was a football player, I won't mention his name, it's quite famous, who was accepting an award, and in the audience was his buddy who was playing football with him, and he had wanted to make mention as he was accepting the award that I want to thank you because years ago when we were in high school, you caught me walking home with all of my books. I had taken all my books home from school that day, and that's the day you saw those group of boys come up to me and push me down and knock all my books down, which they had done different times before. But you came over that one time, being popular as you were, and you helped me get my books and you helped me go home, and then you allowed me to start working out with you. And I began to have a fondness for working out and have a fondness for football. And then we ended up going to the same college and playing football. And then we went to the pros. And he had wanted to tell him one thing you never knew is that I had taken all my books home, not because I had so much homework, because I was going to go home and kill myself. I had been bullied enough. No one was talking to me. And I was being ostracized. And I had decided to end my life and my teens. And when the boys had pushed me down, I was looking for just one reason to stay alive. And when they pushed me down, they gave me confirmation this world would be better off without me. And it wasn't until you helped me get home and took time to be my friend that I realized I could go on one more day, and one more day led to weeks and months and years. And we went to college and played football in the pros. And I just wanted you to know that I wouldn't be alive here if you hadn't stopped and helped me. So that's why I mentioned homework and why I mentioned saying hello, because that young man, I don't know where the game of football would be without him. And there's a lot of people out there like that right now, living under a bridge, that are wearing a gun and a badge, that are having a judge's role, that are being sworn in as a politician, that is bagging groceries, that is delivering Uber food, Uber Eats, that Lyft driver. You know, I want to say this much, America's at the top of the list, and you may be part of that, spending countless monies on cybersecurity. All of you who are on the internet watching us, how much money do you spend to Norton or McAfee because you're protecting your internet health? But what about your mental health? How much money do you spend on your mental health? Yes, I would love you to say hello to someone and just tell them, I'm glad you're here. But then I want you to look at you. Can you go home and look in the mirror and say, hello, I'm glad you're here too? If you can't do that, then you're spending too much money on cybersecurity and not mental security. We'll deal with physical. You know, you're going to be overweight, you're going to be underweight, you're going to be whatever. You know, you need a haircut, you need whatever. But mental health should be the number one priority. So not only do I want to give you homework just to say hello to people, I want you to spend some time, some money on your mental health. Tony, what does that mean? That means that as much as you're on the internet, look up how you can control and how you can help your mental health in your area. It may mean just talking to somebody. I don't know what it means to you. That's why mental health is so unique, because each person has a different need and a want.
for mental health. Add up in a month how much you spent, or a year, how much you spent on cybersecurity and how much you spent on mental security. I love you. Some of you I may never meet. Ruby and Bill and Greg and some of you other ones and Paula. I don't know you, but I love you, and I'm glad you're here. Take care of you, because you know what? We need you. And that's all I want to say. Thank you, sir.
All right, bro. With that, we're going to get out of here. Thank everybody for being here. Keith, Joe, man, great.
Really? Oh, my
God.
That's what you got out of
that.
Wow.
But we're
going to
get out.
No respect. No respect.
Love everybody. Appreciate everybody. Yeah, we got
the recording stopped.